Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome back to New Books in Anthropology on the New Books Network. I'm Jacob Doherty, the host for this episode. Today, we're talking to Professor Lindsay Green Sims, Associate Professor of Literature at American University and author of Postcolonial Automobility, Car Culture in West Africa, published in 2017 by the University of Minnesota Press. Lindsay Green Sims, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the book, can you tell me a bit about your background and how you came to this topic?
Sure. So this started out as a dissertation at the University of Minnesota. It's morphed quite a bit from that. But I was in the Department of Cultural Studies and Comparative Literature. And the idea for this came one particular semester. I believe it was my second or third year of graduate school. And I was taking two seminars at the same time. One was a seminar about globalization theory with Timothy Brennan. And in that class, we were reading all sorts of theories about space-time compression, the speed of modernity, the spread of modernity, all sorts of things that one would read to think about global shifts and global changes. And at the same time, I was taking an African cinema class with Charlie Sugnet. And where this project came from really was the dissonance between these two seminars. In the African cinema class, we were watching a lot of films that reproduced the effective experience of living and traveling and moving in West Africa that really didn't match up and align with this idea of, you know, speed and lines of flight that I was reading about in the globalization class. And we were watching, and I had actually, I had studied abroad in Cameroon in 1999. So when I was taking this African cinema class, I remember feeling that some of the films that we were watching, actually in particular Cartier-Mozart, which becomes one of the main films I discuss in chapter three, I remember thinking that these films really felt really matched experiences of traveling and automobility. So in Cartier-Mozart by Jean-Pierre Bacalo, there's this one scene where this police chief pulls over a man in a wheelchair because the man was speeding down a hill. And I remember just being really struck by that scene, in part because of its humor, but also of the way that it really connected power to mobility, and the way that I had experienced in Cameroon. There was at one point where I was taking a taxi somewhere, and the taxi got pulled over, and they didn't have like the proper emergency equipment or some very, very minor infraction, which was really, they didn't have the bribe to pay. And the taxi guy got like taken away. And I remember being sort of like tossed out on the road in this city that I had just arrived in with this large duffel bag and just kind of feeling bewildered. But Cartier-Mozart really also reproduces this feeling of bewilderment, in an urban setting in the 1990s, which is very specific. In the 1980s, Cameroon had this really powerful middle class and paved roads and traffic circles. And during the era of structural adjustment, this was really becoming undone. So anyway, this is sort of a long way of saying that the idea for this book emerged out of the very different types of things that I was reading and trying to put these together, trying to think about how car culture, how automobility in West Africa is and is part of this globalization discourse and also counters it.
Great, thanks. And so to get started, to dive right into the book, could you lay out one of the kind of parallel arguments that you make to that throughout the book about how West African experiences of automobility disclose some of the paradoxes, not just of globalization, but of automobility as a cultural system, as that's developed in the United States?
Yeah. So actually, you know, part of the background too ties into that. At first, this was really going to be a book that critiqued this idea of automobility. And by what I mean by automobility isn't just cars that move. I'm thinking about it in particular about the what it enables. So the auto and automobility being about this self-propelled journey. Mike Featherstone talks about how the auto and automobile was initially referring to the idea of a self-propelled motor vehicle that was free from the dependence on an animal. And James Flink and the automobile age talks about this mass personal automobility. So I was really thinking about automobility as this sort of individualized form of mobility and about critiques of it. There's a book called Against Automobility, which was something that I read really early on. I think it's 2006. I think I read it right when it came out. But the editors there in their intro talk about how the pursuit of individual mobility becomes collective immobility. So they're talking about all these core antagonisms of automobility, right? So this idea that you can get in the car that's not dependent on a track or a timetable, and you can go wherever you want, whenever you want, is sort of contradicted or upended by the fact that this car depends on oil, on car manufacturers, on laws, on police officers, on roads, on signs, advertisements, gas stations. So it's really the system of dependency. And that was what I was really thinking about. The original idea, the chapters that I kind of imagined first were the chapter about Francophone cinema, and the chapter about Shoyinka and the road accident. So I was really at first kind of thinking about how these films contradict or bring out these core antagonisms of automobility. But then as I progressed and I did more research, I started thinking about Nollywood films, African popular culture. I was doing archival research into car and learning about, which we'll probably get into later, but learning about how African entrepreneurs during the colonial era were really responsible for motorizing West Africa. They were the ones that brought in cars, and the colonialists, the colonial officers were like, you know, a little not particularly enthusiastic about it at first. So the more that I got into it, the more that I started thinking about all the pleasures and all the possibilities that car culture provided, and all the ways that automobility was also about self-making and self-realization. So then the sort of contradictions that I was thinking about originally began to shift a little bit. I noticed that in West African film and literature, cars are discussed with really a particular urgency and also a particular ambivalence, and it's not. It's never about one thing in particular. So it's about how automobiles are part of this lived experience in an unevenly globalized world where technology sometimes breaks down or sometimes doesn't work or cars are, you know, older or repaired. But also at the same time, it's very much a part of self-making, a part of what it means to be an aspirational modern subject. And so these were some of the arguments that began to drive, no pun intended, that began to drive the narrative of my book.
And you write that a lot of the texts that you're engaging with, the films, novels, plays, you write that they don't simply represent cars or reflect automobility in West Africa, but are productive heuristic forms where the creators work through the relationships between people and cars. So can you say a bit about how this approach informs your reading of the key texts and aesthetic objects in the book?
Yeah, exactly. I didn't want it to just be like, oh, and this is, I think this is a lot of the work of literary studies is to kind of reject this. It's simply a representation of the social. So Carolyn Levine has a book on forms, and her work was really useful in helping me kind of think about and articulate. And I think that's actually, I think the productive heuristic forms, I think, is a paraphrase from her. But she talks about how narratives are particularly valuable because they set in motion and they can track different social forms, and they can look at how social forms come into conflict with each other and overlap. For me in particular, is also looking at feelings, how they reproduce feelings of aspiration or frustration. And Levine also mentions Bruno Latour, and she says that he says in passing, she talks about a comment where he says in passing that fiction writers are better than sociologists at capturing social relationships because they can experiment. Now, I'm not saying that fiction writers are necessarily better. Actually, some of my best friends are sociologists. But there is something unique in particular about fiction at work, narrative fiction, that I work with and play with and work through. And this also has a lot to do with form. Automobility is the social form that I look at, but I'm looking at what happens when it intersects in different literary forms, in a Nollywood film, which, you know, or popular melodramas, the Nollywood films, or in a feminist novel, or in a Francophone art cinema that's expressing frustration with modernity, different aspects of the contradictions of automobility kind of become palpable and become apparent when you look at them in different literary forms.
So the first chapter is called The Hum of Progress, and it focuses on the entwined histories of modernization and motorization in the colonial era. And as you mentioned, colonial administrators were often hostile to the idea of motorizing Africa, but African entrepreneurs were very active in establishing a system of automobility nonetheless. So why the colonial ambivalence about the car?
Well, to begin with, before World War I, cars, before Fords, lighter weight Fords were introduced, cars were really heavy and they tore up roads. Sometimes they competed with the railroads that the colonialists had spent a lot of time and energy building, and that they were using to extract goods. And sometimes I talk about the introduction of the first car into French Western Africa in 1900. There was a businessman, a French businessman named Félix Dubois. There's a whole article about, you know, how he was ahead of his time and he was great. But what I discovered is sort of buried in this article, which I found in the National Archives in Dakar, was this comment from the governor of French Western Africa at the time that he was nervous that photographers were there taking pictures of this first journey. And what he was nervous about was that the car would break down and that French modernity and technology would basically look silly and look foolish. So there was also just sort of this skepticism about whether cars were really suited for the roads. But at the same time, West African entrepreneurs and chiefs didn't really seem to have this ambivalence. So another story I tell is about in Benin during World War I. These local chiefs had received compensation money for recruiting soldiers, and so they used this to try to buy cars. And they had asked some colonial officers to help them procure the cars, and then the colonial officers basically tried to dupe them out of their cars. And in a sense, they were embarrassed that the chiefs were able to get cars before they were. But I mean, also there was definitely this underlying racist ideology that, you know, Africans are primitive and not developed enough to drive, to own cars, to maintain cars, which was, of course, ridiculous because the Africans were doing this way before the Europeans were in West Africa.
So what were some of the practices that they were involved with in terms of importing or using cars at this time?
Yeah, they were the first. They were really pushing the importation of cars. They were kind of organically developing these like they're called indigenous transport systems, where that still are how most people travel in West Africa today, where you have a car, you get people, when the car fills up, you go. There's not bus schedules or timetables, but it had a certain amount of flexibility. In Ghana, Nigeria, at the same time, there were these colonial film units that were traveling around showing these very didactic British documentaries. And some of the drivers of the colonial film unit vans would actually just, you know, use them to transport passengers at the end of the day and make money. So there were a lot of ways that Africans saw that cars, especially after World War One, especially when Fords came in and they were lighter and easier, that Africans saw that this could be profitable, this could be modernizing, this could be very useful to them. So they were definitely more interested at first than colonial officers were.
And how did drivers appear in some of the kind of key texts of books, films that were emerging in that period?
Yeah. So it's interesting because now I think drivers have this, especially drivers of taxi drivers or tro-tro drivers or different indigenous transport are kind of seen as low class. But in the 1950s, not so much in the 1930s, but by the 1950s, they really were these kind of cosmopolitan, like cool, hip figures. And the film that stands out the most is the very first film made by the Gold Coast Film Unit, called The Boy Kumasenu, which was 1952. And the Afro jazz drummer Guy Warren plays this kind of cool lorry driver. Ken Saro-Wiwa's Soza Boy, which was written in the 80s, but it talks about the main character Mene, who is an apprentice driver for this truck named Progress, which of course has lots of different meanings. How he was very excited because he thought that once he would apprentice for a while and then get his own license and then get his own truck. And he said, if he saves up his money and he saves up his chop money or his food money, then he could buy his own truck and that he could be a big man like any lawyer or doctor. So this idea that driving could provide you not only with status, but with a very, a very respectable income, was certainly present in the 1950s and 60s, though it has, that has changed a bit.
And then moving a little bit into the first decades of independence, you contrast two novels by Usman Semben, God's Bits of Wood and Niwam, to highlight some of the disillusionment and longing for infrastructural modernity that took place then. So could you say a bit about Usman Semben as a key figure throughout the book? Could you just say a bit about who he was and what these novels reveal about this post-independence disillusionment?
Yeah. Semben is definitely one of the key figures. He's often referred to as the father of African cinema. In the Francophone cinema chapter, I talk about his first film, Warum Sheret. But before he was a filmmaker, he wrote novels. In 1960, he wrote a novel called God's Bits of Wood, which is a fictional account of the 1947 Dakar Niger railway strike. And actually, he had taken part in that strike as well. And in this film, in this novel, I wish it were a film, that would be fun. He talks about the train and technology as as part of this machine-based future. And he talks about how the strikers kind of gather at the railroad station, and they begin to realize that, you know, as they strike, that the machine, even though it was built by the colonials, that the machine belongs to them. So there's this very sort of optimistic and in some ways feeling about what transport technology can do and feel. And, you know, this is 1960 that it's written, so, or that it's published. So right at the, on the cusp of independence. The other story that I talk about in this chapter is Niwam, which was, it's a novella that was actually made into a film, but not by Senben, by Clarence Delgado. Niwam was written in 1976. And it's about this man who's from the village. He comes to Dakar with his sick son. His son dies, his baby dies at the hospital. And he's kind of shocked to learn that the cemetery that he has to travel to is all the way across the town. And so it takes place on this bus, you know, this mode of public transportation.
So in chapter two, No Danger, No Delay, you tell this remarkable story about the Nigerian playwright and author, Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka, and his involvement in road safety campaigns in Nigeria. So could you say a little bit about this? This was really remarkable for me. Who was Soyinka and what role did he play in road safety in Nigeria?
Yeah, it was remarkable for me as well. And I think I said in the intro, this was one of the first chapters that I had had envisioned because of the way that he thinks about the accident. But so Soyinka is, he's you know, probably one of the most famous African writers. He's a Nobel Prize laureate. But he's also famous for being political. He had spent 2 years in prison after trying to broker a peace deal during the Nigerian Civil War, the Biafran War. He was exiled for speaking out against Abacha. But what isn't really known or talked about, which is sort of less sensational, but obviously for me just as interesting, is that he was a huge advocate of road safety reform, and he actually urged the creation of the Oyo State Road Safety Corps in the 1970s and actually went out and patrolled streets. He wrote review sketches and comedies, and he was very active in talking about, right, safety and slowing down and caution on the road. And then actually in 1988, the Federal Road Safety Corps was formed, and it basically was an expansion of the one that he had urged the creation. Babangida was the military regime of Babangida was in power then, and Soyinka accepted an invitation to sit on the council, and then to become its chairman. And he kind of got a lot of slack for, you know, here's this like anti-government figure for working with the military regime of the time, but, you know, for him it was like, you know, he was just appalled, you see it in, you know, not just the play The Road that I talk about, but in some of his poems, Death and the Dawn, he was appalled at the carnage on the road. And so he was not only writing about it and writing about it from a philosophical, and very metaphysical point of view, but also from a really practical point of view. So yeah, it was remarkable to me because in a sense, it kind of captured a lot of the things that I was thinking about and talking about in this project at large, the confluence of the literary form and the form of automobility and what happens when they intersect.
But he's not at all didactic in his representation of it or his treatment of it. So can you tell us a bit about the road?
No. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Did you ask me if I could talk a bit about the road?
Yeah, so you say it sort of develops this idea of the Ongunian road. So maybe start with that.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I'm sorry, you were cutting out a little bit, but I got that. Yeah, so the Ogun is the patron god of the road and the god that Soyinka kind of connects with. He's the god of metal and iron, but also creativity and new technology and transition. And so Ogun and the road are both the site of both creation and destruction. So the play, I mean, it's a little bit hard to summarize it in terms of the plot, but it takes place on the urban periphery. there's touts. So the people that kind of like hustle you into the trucks and truck drivers. This character called the professor who runs a store out of an empty bulakaja. And a bulakaja was this kind of truck with a open back. It was one of the earlier forms of collective transport. And so he runs a store called the Accident Store. It's also a bar, and he sells parts and goods that are gleaned from accident sites. At the end of the play, he's killed by one of the characters, and he has this kind of incredible speech where he's saying, and he's kind of the bad guy in a sense of this of in some ways of the play, and that he's sort of capitalizing on death and the accidents. But he's got this speech at the end where he says to, you know, he advises the people at the bar to breathe like the road and be the road. And considering the whole play is about accidents and accident sites and this driver who gets into accidents and becomes, you know, really just mentally paralyzed.
For Soyinka, the crash is the paradigmatic scene of West African automobility. But in chapter 3, Moving Pictures, Mired Cars, it's the broken down car that's at the center. So can you say what the two films are at the center of this chapter and how they used the stalled car to convey their picture of mobility?
Yeah. So the first film that I look at is Ousmane Sembène's Hala. The second film is Jean-Pierre Bacalo's Cartier-Mozart, which I mentioned at the beginning. But Sembène's Hala is a 1973 film. It's oftentimes considered his masterpiece. It's the protagonist is a man named Alhaji Abdoulkader Bey, and the film takes place at this. It's got a great opening scene where it was the first time that Senegalese has taken the presidency of the Chamber of Commerce. So all the men are celebrating. Alhaji invites them to his wedding. He's taking a third wife on. They all sort of celebrate the fact that an African is now in power. Interestingly, there's a scene where Frenchmen come in and hand each of the men a briefcase of money. So the implication, of course, is though the African elite has taken, or the national bourgeoisie has taken power, they're still backed by the French. Then they each of these men get into their own fancy automobile. Most of them are Mercedes. One of them is a Ford. And this is a really long, drawn out scene where they get into their cars. The cars sort of parade around the Place de l'Independence, and it's the cars are a very big part of this opening scene. It turns out that Alhaji Hala actually means the curse of impotence. So Alhaji has been struck with the curse of impotence on his wedding night. And a large part of the film revolves around him trying to figure out who put the curse on him. And it turns out that it's a group of beggars that had put the curse on him because he had tricked them and misappropriated their land and sold their land. So he's responsible for their poverty and they're responsible for his curse. And at the end of the film, Alhaji, the film is very much about Alhaji's downward spiral, the downward spiral of the elite. At the end of the film, his precious Mercedes that he's, you know, taken care to wash with Evian water is actually repossessed, and it's pushed off screen because none of the soldiers that are repossessing his car actually know how to drive a car. So there's a great scene where the three men are literally pushing the Mercedes off screen. So the Mercedes comes to symbolize the excesses of the post-colonial elite that Sembène removes. Bacalo is oftentimes seen as a filmmaker who's set up kind of in contrast to Sembène. Sembène films in the social realist mode. Bacalo is very avant-garde, very experimental, kind of all over the place. His film Cartier-Mozart takes place in Cameroon in the 1990s. So we're dealing with a different era. Instead of immediate post-independence, we're dealing with the period of structural adjustment. And I write that for Bacalo's film, stasis is the point of departure. So he's filming Cameroon that is very much in the midst of structural adjustment. In Cameroon, cars, which are tend to be very old at this point in the 90s, 20, 30 years old, are often called congelés or frozens, in part because they stall all the time, and in part because Cameroonians also called, because of structural adjustment, they had to have, there was a lot of imported frozen chicken, and the chickens were also called congelés. So it's kind of this pun where congelés refer both to the broken down car and also to the stasis that is a result of structural adjustment. So in Bekele's film, cars, sort of broken down cars or abandoned cars, really litter the neighborhood.
So sticking with Bekele just for the moment, you also show how he uses cars as staging grounds for thinking about new kinds of mobility and new imaginaries of movement and travel. So how does he convey that in the film?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as I mentioned in the previous answer, Bekele's kind of known for this, for breaking the rules of cinema. A lot of film scholars have written about how the car and the film, the car and the moving camera are connected. Gilles Deleuze says that the camera is the equivalent of the airplane or the car or the boat. And Paul Virilio talks about, you know, what goes on in the windscreen is cinema in the strict sense. A lot of other theorists, Kristen Ross comes to mind, talks about the car and the camera being, you know, dual mechanisms for mobility and modern consumption. They instantiate similar forms of subjectivity in space-time. And this was also particularly the case in colonial films. I talk about in chapter one, La Croisière Noire, which is this film about Citroën. They're called caterpillar cars that tour Africa with a camera mounted on the front. And there are a lot of documentaries, especially French documentaries, with a camera mounted on the front. So the car and the camera are really paired together. Bekele tries to undo this coupling. And instead of having the car symbolize the movement of the camera, he oftentimes stalls his film. He puts in cars that don't really make sense. So in Cartier Mozart, the main character is Queen of the Hood, and she transforms magically into My Guide, a teenage boy, because she wants the sort of the mobility and freedom of the neighborhood boys. This takes place in a stalled car, but it's a really interesting scene. It's all in the dark. Bekele kind of tows the car on the scene, and then she transforms, and then the car is towed off. And I'm using the passive voice because it's not clear who's towing the car and why it's there. And then he, as a narrator, says, you know, where are they taking that car? I don't know. I'm going back to sleep. So he kind of denies the logic of the narrator, who gets to say and see things. And in another scene, rather than putting the camera behind the windshield to sort of, you know, take in the landscape, he uses the windshield as a place where people write rumors about Queen of the Hood and Samedi. Samedi's the police chief's daughter. It's actually not Queen of the Hood at that point. She's transformed into My Guy. So people write rumors about My Guy and Samedi. And this is in direct defiance to what the police chief said, which is, you know, keep this relationship quiet, keep it secret. And so the windscreen becomes a place for kind of defying the police chief in passing notes and passing information, rather than what the windshield in cinema it normally looks like. So there's just a couple examples, but there's a lot of times in the film where Bekele uses the camera to sort of display and engage with ideas and images of stasis.
Going back to Halle, there we see automobiles are central to the construction of gender relations and different portraits of women in the film. There's the gift of a Mercedes as part of the wedding, which is contrasted with Rama, the daughter of El Hajj, who's an incredible figure in the film, and she's moving around on a moped throughout. So could you expand a bit on this contrast and the dynamic between the moped and the
stalled
car?
Yeah, so Rama I'm glad you brought her up. She's a fascinating figure in this film. So she's El Haji's daughter. I mentioned in a previous answer that El Haji, you know, uses Evian water to wash his car. And so there's this one dialogue where she goes to visit him at work and he offers her some Evian water and she says, I only drink tap water. So she's in many ways set up as his foil. He speaks to her in French. She responds in Wolof. He wears Western business suits and she wears African boo-boos, but then also sometimes bell bottoms. He was a former revolutionary who, you know, as you can tell from the plot, sort of plot summary before, betrays the ideals, and she espouses those ideals. Her driving a moped is one more example of how she's set up as his foil. The interesting thing is that in the novel version of Hollow, which Senben wrote as he was trying to piece together funding for the film, she doesn't drive a moped. She drives a Fiat. And so what I think is interesting about that is this is my theory, and I haven't been able to confirm it, but the actress who plays Rama is, her name is Myriam Nyang, and she had played the year before the figure of Anta in Gilbert Mambeti's Tuki Buki. So Mambeti is this kind of surrealist filmmaker, and Tuki Buki is this wild kind of Easy Rider meets Bonnie and Clyde meets nothing that you've ever seen before, like motorcycle film around Dakar. And Anta and her boyfriend Mori ride around on this motorcycle that has like zebu horns on the front. Actually, Beyonce and Jay-Z kind of used one of their promotional photos for the On the Run tour. Basically, they were pretending to be Anta and Mori on this motorcycle. So Anta is this rebellious figure, and she's, you know, they kind of travel around a car, they steal money, they're trying to, you know, get enough money to go to Paris. And so I think that Anta also informs the character of Rama in the film as she transforms from the novel to the film. So I think a lot of ways Rama also signals, if El-Haji and his Mercedes signal the excess of the urban post-colonial elite that have kind of stalled the country. You know, Hala is literally means the curse of impotence. So the film is really, you know, an allegory about the impotence of the elite, of the national bourgeoisie. Rama presents in many ways, not in all ways, because she's a complicated figure, but in many ways, an alternative to that, an alternative form of moving the nation forward and an alternative mobility.
And she's selecting the parts of international modernity that she wants to draw on, and
exactly,
sort of coupling together.
Exactly. She's not seen as this, you know, this traditionalist in any way. She's, you know, she's got some posters in her room of Charlie Chaplin and also of you know, African revolutionary figures. So she's really kind of seen as, yeah, piecing things together in a way that I think that Senben is saying that this is a way forward.
In chapter four, then, you move from Francophone African cinema to Nollywood, where cars take on an entirely different role, but continue to have a place in related critiques around criminality, the ethics of accumulation, and discourses of corruption. So why is this chapter called Return of the Mercedes, and what picture of automobility emerges out of Nollywood?
Yeah, so Return of the Mercedes is in large part a reference back to the Mercedes that was pushed off screen in Hala. The thing about Nollywood film is that, so I mentioned earlier on in our conversation about how automobility is the main sort of social form that I look at. But in each of the chapters, I look at what happens when automobility as a social form kind of comes into contact or intersects with different literary forms. So in the Francophone chapter, Francophone art film chapter, when automobility intersects with Francophone art film, you've got these different images of stasis. Nollywood is a different game altogether. Nollywood films are highly melodramatic. They're long. They last, they're several parts. They're really influenced by like the Latin American telenovelas that were on TV and popular in soap operas. So they have a very different aesthetic. The video boom, as it was called, started in Nigeria. It started in the early 90s, and Ghana it started a little bit before that. The Ghanaians were actually first, even though Nollywood is sort of more well known and famous. And it started at a time in Nigeria where there was under military rule. There was again a lot of economic scarcity that was mixed with economic abundance. So this sort of contrast between the nouveau riche and the people that were finding it harder and harder to survive on a daily basis. And also you had the influx of video technology, what Brian Larkin calls infrastructures of piracy, meaning that video VHS tapes at that time were really easy to copy and to distribute. And you also had a lot of out-of-state television workers. You had people that had been in the theater that had talent and know-how, but that weren't theater performances. People were finding it harder to pay for theater performances. Curfews meant it was hard to go to the cinema at night. So you kind of have all these factors that kind of mixed together to create this boom. Nollywood is the second largest film industry in the world now in terms of volume. The films that they were making in the 1990s, one of the most famous popular genres, it's gone out of fashion, but one of the most famous genres is sort of the occult film or the money ritual film. And so the first film that I write about, and also the first film that kind of created this boom, it wasn't the first Nollywood film, but it was the first film that was popular enough for people to realize, wow, like we could do something here. This is an industry. It's called Living in Bondage by Kenneth Nebwe. The main character is a guy named Andy who moves from his village to Lagos. And he's trying to figure out how to make money. And he's got a regular job, but he looks around him and he says a lot of his friends have gotten really rich. And the opening monologue, he's talking about, you know, so-and-so has a Mercedes, so-and-so has a Pathfinder, you know, what have I done wrong? And he runs into a friend of his named Paul. And Paul says, well, I can show you how to make money if you really want it, but you've got to have heart, something like that. And then he says, yes, I want that. And it turns out that Paul is part of a cult, the cult of Lord Lucifer. And in order to obtain wealth and riches and the Mercedes and the mansions, Andy's required to sacrifice somebody that he loves. And he's very shocked by this. He doesn't want to do it. But the men eventually convince him that, you know, if he sacrifices his wife, he'll get another wife, or he sacrifices somebody he cares about. It won't matter because he'll have so much money that he won't be concerned with anymore. So he consents and he brings his wife. Her name is Merritt. So he sacrifices her in this sort of bloodletting ritual, and he becomes very wealthy. He eventually, several hours later through the film, Merritt begins to haunt him. The ghost of Merritt begins to haunt him, and he goes mad and sort of loses everything. So it's a cautionary tale. And the Mercedes, you know, it's more ambiguous than it is in Hala. So, you know, Andy drives this, and this is, you know, this red blood color Mercedes. He drives this Mercedes that he coveted so much. But, you know, actually at the end of the day, very much like Hala, the way that he got the Mercedes was through nefarious means. So the Nollywood films sort of both display this wealth, I think, in a way that the Francophone films don't, I should say that the Nollywood films, they linger a lot more on the conspicuous consumption. In Hala, the Mercedes driving elite is kind of parodied from the beginning, even though there's that long drawn out scene. But in Nollywood films, there's a lot of conspicuous consumption. And that's part of the point. Audiences get to sort of revel in the conspicuous consumption, but then also, you know, understand at the end of the film that there's going to be a sort of moral
And
judgment.
So when you're talking about the 2007 Boys Cut, you trace a transition from the occult to the 419 as the kind of key index of corruption at the center of these that sort of draws out the contrast that you're pointing out between this vast luxurious consumer lifestyles in a context where there's not very many legitimate strategies towards wealth accumulation. So how does this appear in Boy's Cut, and how do Cars and the 419 fit together there?
Yeah, so she's the novel that I discussed changes is her second novel. Her first novel is Our Sister Killjoy, which is it's a novella in 1977 about the main character Sissy's time in Germany. That's really probably her more famous novel, but she's this sort of woman of many talents. She writes novels. She wrote theater, popular theater. She was the minister of education at one point. I first came across her work, I think, when I was reading the intro to Ayukwe Arma's The Beautiful Ones Are Not Yet Born. And she talks about, you know, she kind of critiques this novel, and she says that some of his female characters are, they're not believable characters because they're not economically autonomous. And she says Ghanaian women always find a way to have their own income and make their own money. They're creative in that sense. And so she says that there's not really the explanation for women's oppression isn't really economic. It has to do with these larger social systems. And that's what a lot of her work addresses is these larger social systems. So she's actually really a fascinating writer, and Changes it's not a novel that people talk about or write about a lot. But one of the fun things is that when I've given conference presentations on this or when people have picked up my book, several people have said, oh, I think I'm going to have to think about teaching Changes now in a story on, you know, African women's writing or hopefully that'll continue to happen, because Changes is really, I think, a phenomenal novel. So the texts take place about 10 years apart. Changes, the main character of Changes is Essie, and she's a data analyst for the Department of Urban Statistics. And at the beginning of the novel, she's the subject of marital rape. Her husband rapes her. But there's not really a word for that, for her to say that. It doesn't make sense in her society to say that a husband rapes her. So she divorces him, but isn't really able to give anybody a reason why. Throughout the novel, she's kind of dealing with the fallout of that. So the novel is really interesting. Both texts open with women and women drivers, and cars are very, you know, much part of the daily lives. So she's basic. She's at once she's this sort of like kind of autonomous feminist. She enjoys work. Being single gives her sort of freedom to like bring her work home with her. Kind of do what she wants. She's got this car. She's got this house. She can kind of live freely. But she's also not particularly happy. So the novel is Changes, a Love Story, is the subtitle of it. And it's very much, I read it as a sort of sarcastic, like, what are the actual changes that she's capable of giving, given the systems that she has to navigate? Fat Kine is a little bit different in tone. It takes place 10 years later. Both kind of take place at the cusp of their country's transition to neoliberalism. So Fat Kine is born the year of Senegal's independence. It takes place just before the end of socialist presidents and socialist rule in Senegal. I'm hesitating because even in Hala, there was a kind of a critique of like, what exactly is this, you know, what exactly is socialist about the regime. But anyway, Fat Kine takes place just before Abdoulaye Wade comes to power. And she's this woman, she's a single mom of two. The fathers of both of the children have left her. One was a professor that took advantage of her. The other was a guy who basically duped her out of her money. And so she's raising these two kids, Abby and Jeep, on her own. She's at the beginning driving them to, she's dropping them off. It's the day that the results of their BAC are going to come out. So they're going to find out, you know, how they scored, where they can police into schools. And she's also the manager of a gas station. She started out as a gas station, an attendant, a pompiste, and now she's the manager of this gas station. So the whole film really is about kind of her taking control of mobility. And it is very, very significant that it's a gas station, right? So she kind of oversees these cars that come and go. So she's the center of Fat Kine, which I read really also as a sort of like a feminist reimagining of Hala in many ways.
Yeah, and that contrast between highly visible wealth in the form of cars and highly invisible sources of wealth really runs through it in this important way.
Yeah, so a lot of what these texts, the novel and the film, are getting at is how do you get by? How do you negotiate daily life in a city, in a post-colonial city? How do you negotiate urban structures? And how do you negotiate patriarchal structures? So when I say that they're a lot about maintenance, I'm really thinking about how do you maintain, and a lot of them are about sort of the emotional state of these characters, right? So how do you maintain emotional and mental stability. I work too with Obiama and Nemeka's concept of nego feminism, which is a feminism that kind of is about negotiation, about how you cope, how you kind of successfully get by and go around. So a lot of what the, yeah. So rather than, you know, in the Nollywood films and Hala, it's a lot about aspiration, about getting the car, about getting the fancy car. And cars in these two texts, they're much more ordinary. The characters aren't, you know, trying to move up. They've basically, you know, they're basically leading these middle class lives. So it's not about how they move up or you know, it's really how they move around and get by.
So in the introduction, you introduced this idea about misplaced mobility. So to wrap up the conversation about the book, can you explain how your analysis of West African automobility misplaces or displaces the concept of mobility itself and what we can learn from West African mobility about mobility in general?
Yeah, so throughout the book, so I talk, when I say that automobility is misplaced, I'm utilizing Roberta Schwartz's concept of misplaced ideas. So it's not that automobility doesn't apply in a West African context. It's that the same systems that created automobility in the US aren't present in West Africa. So that when you transport it, and actually when he's introducing, it's interesting because when Schwartz is introducing his concept of misplaced ideas, he's talking about Brazil, and he says something, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, we didn't create romanticism and we didn't create the car industry, but, you know, when you import it into Brazil, interesting things happen. And so he was also talking about both cars and literary forms. So when automobility comes into West Africa, the argument that I'm making, playing off of Schwartz, is that the core antagonisms, this idea that automobility is always about personalized individual mobility, that kind of prevents collective mobility, this core antagonism, just becomes clearer in different ways and comes to the fore in different ways. So I do, in my conclusion, I talk about how it's a book that's about West African automobility, but I hope that people that are interested in thinking about automobility or thinking about car culture more broadly also can kind of see some of these core antagonisms, these contradictions of automobility, sort of the multiple ways that the car is part of aspiration and part of modernity and part of self-making and also, you know, part of the destruction that's very inherent in it. How that comes to the fore. And I actually think about this. I've been thinking about it a lot lately because I just started, this is kind of embarrassing in a way. I just started to drive. I've known how to drive, but I haven't had a car with the exception of 1 year for a long time. And people oftentimes ask me if I'm a car fanatic, and that's what kind of, you know, drew me to this project. And actually, which at this point in our conversation shouldn't be surprising, what drew me to the project is I have a profound ambivalence about cars. So we recently moved away from, I lived in Washington, D.C. We used to live in an apartment right on a bus line and very close to a metro stop. We moved away and wound up getting a second car. And so in some ways, which is a relief in some ways, because before we got the second car and we lived here, I was taking two different buses to get my kids to their two different schools, and then an Uber or a metro and a train to campus. It took 2 hours on the days that I had to get my kids to school. So we got this car, and all of a sudden I have, you know, I've got more time. I've got more time to class prep, and which means that at night I don't have to class prep in the same way, and more time to hang out with students on campus because I can get to pick up the kids sooner. But also I've got this profound ambivalence in that I'm now another car on the road, and I'm using gas in a way that I wasn't, right? Did you know, the car I bought was not a Tesla. And I'm less social. I don't run into people on the bus or the metro in the way that I used to. And so, you know, I'm thinking about this in my own life, and this is kind of the rub of neoliberal capitalism away, right? What is good for the individual, what's making my life easier, is not necessarily good for the social or good for the collective, right? I'm now also another car competing in DC traffic. So, you know, just at this personal level, but really the social implications of all that, right? Because automobility, what's so fascinating about it to me from the get-go is that the car is just this part of everyday life that people are always talking about, always thinking about, always making use of, but also that's connected to all these global issues, these global problems at the city level, right? That it's connected to so many things. So it's this everyday object that's also connected to so many broader important issues.
Yeah, as a child of the DC suburbs myself, I certainly know that frustration and freedom that comes with comes with car culture there. So we've taken up a lot of your time, and I'm very grateful.
Right. Yeah, it's very ambivalent. Yeah.
So we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us a bit about the project you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, right now I'm finishing up a sabbatical, and I'm finishing up the first draft of a book called Queer African Cinemas. So in some ways it's very different than the automobility project, but in some ways I'm working with a lot of the same themes about looking at different forms that films are taking and how they deal with queerness and questions of resistance. So I've got a chapter on Nollywood film again, and a chapter that looks at some Francophone films again. Also, it's not, I've moved out of just the West African framework. So I also looking at South Africa and East Africa, some of the films that have been coming out of Kenya in particular over the past couple of years. So it's fun. My head has been in that project for so long. So it was kind of a nice break to go back and re-look at post-colonial automobility and kind of think about some of the things that made that first book click and connect.
Well, that sounds like a fantastic project, and I look forward to seeing that when it comes out. Thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Anthropology. I've really enjoyed our conversation, despite some technical difficulties.
Well, apropos, right? No, thank you very much for having me. It's been great.